right, welcome to Pixel Punishers Podcast, Episode 1. I am Tony Roseland here with our producer, Chase Warnick. What's up, Chase?
Hello.
And of course, on the other side of the country and a little bit north is the legend, the pride of Canada, the meat scrim himself, Mr. Barry McKenzie. What's up, Barry?
Hi, guys. I'm actually a little bit south of you, not north. So maybe you should look at a map. I don't know.
Well, they say Canada is America's top hat or whatever. So, you know, you're north of us. So,
okay.
Dude, how are you, man? I haven't seen you in a while.
I'm good, man. I had a rough Sunday, overindulged last night and had a couple too many refreshments. So it was a slow day around here, but getting everything charged up. I got a couple shoots booked this week, shooting for Hedgeford and Berkeley tomorrow. And then I got a new Millstone model later in the week to shoot. So I'm pretty jacked. What's popping out in sweet Spokesy these days?
Dude, baby keeping me awake, trying to get stuff done around here, building this podcast studio, trying to get this thing off the ground. I went on a bike ride today. Weather was kind of shit and, I wasn't performing at my best, but at least I got in the saddle and did some pedaling, which is pretty good. So, we should probably tell these people what this podcast is about. If they're tuning in for the first time, this is episode 1. So a couple of things right out of the gate, a little bit of echo, our podcast studio here in Spokane. We're waiting on our acoustic panels to come in, which will kill a little bit of the echo in here. We ordered them a couple weeks ago. They just haven't arrived yet, so it'll only get better. And then this podcast is loosely based on photography. We're going to get some special guests on here from all areas of the creative industry, creative and tech industry. But we don't want it to be like every other podcast where we just ask photographers a bunch of questions about their career and their life. We really want to get to know the people. So it's going to be more like, what's your favorite pizza? What kind of grass fertilizer do you use? Whatever, stuff like that. So, if you're into the creative thing, that's what this podcast is all about. So moving forward, that's what you can expect. Also, there might be some drinking happening. There might be some profanity.
Might be.
Possibly some partial nudity. I don't know. We'll see how this thing goes. This is only episode 1, and Chase is already trying to take his pants off.
No, these are not.
Well, I don't even have pants on. I'm just wearing slippers right now. I'm butt naked with slippers on.
Thanks for the visual.
Hey, I'm just putting that out there.
Delete. We have kind of a loose format for these podcasts. We want to have a couple of different things involved in each one, and we'll run through our notes here. But I want to kick this episode off kind of talking about tripods. I like them. I use them. How about you, Barry?
I like a tripod. I like to put my camera up on top of there and make photographs with it.
And that's my nickname is Tripod.
Is it really?
We need some voice like bow, wow, wow, wow. Got to get some sound bites in there. So
we'll work on it.
So I like tripods. So I guess that topic's covered. Let's move on to the next one.
Tony, you have some issues that you're often triggered by tripods.
I do have a huge collection of tripods. Get so and really write stuff. I've got like a fetish for tripods, but buy once, cry once is my motto. Buy a good tripod and you'll never have to buy another one. So I invest the money, but for some reason I keep buying other ones, even though I have one of those.
It's like bikes. You buy bikes and tripods. You just have a stockpile of bikes and tripods.
Yeah. My collection goes further than that though. Sunglasses and backpacks. Those as well. I have so many fucking backpacks, dude. I got like a closet full of them. So I don't know. The right bag, whether it's a camera bag or a backpack, is I'd buy it. I use it. There's things I like and things I don't like, and I'm constantly in the search for the best. But we're getting off topic. Back to tripods, and what irritates the shit out of me is center columns, dude. I take the center columns out of my tripods because that's insane to me. I see it in Instagram and the social media all the time is people setting up this nice, robust Gitzo tripod or whatever, and then they crank the center column up 24, 36 inches in the air when they still have extensions left in the legs. They have sections left in the legs. Why would you do this? This is This is like putting a monopod on top of your tripod, which you have this nice sturdy base, and then you're setting a monopod on top of it. It doesn't make any fucking sense to me.
No.
Barry, is this something that you do?
Well, I have been known to raise my center column, and I think Well, man, for me, coming from my former career of shooting real estate when it's all about moving quick, I mean, having those – I'm not excessive, and my tripod only has like a 12-inch center column, so I can't extend it ridiculously high anyways. But I think for speed, with what I used to do is, you know, when you're moving from a bedroom to a kitchen and you just want to clear an island or something so you can get that vantage point, it's way easier than trying to adjust, you know, the legs. So – that's my defense of why I use it, but
yeah. But you're not shooting real estate anymore, dude. Are you still doing this?
Well, I'm not going to lie. I will use the center column from time to time.
Dude, we're not friends anymore. You're not my best friend anymore.
We can still be friends,
dude. Okay, so but looking at people online, I'm looking at guys that are working at a high level, and they're cranking the center column 30 inches in the air when they still have two or three sections of their tripod left. And it's like, it makes me itch. It makes me start to shake.
Your eye twitches a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I just want to call them out on it and be like, what the hell is wrong with you? But
I know what's wrong with these. I know what's wrong. I mean, we all know the answer. It's just being lazy. It's way easier to just lift that column up than it is to reset things, especially, and you know, I mean, if you're like have composition mostly dialed and you just want to get that, you know, tweak that height a little bit, I see where that's happening. But just, I mean, there are people that run from shot to shot with the thing fully extended, which is crazy to me. So I think it's just laziness. I mean, it's human nature to not want to do it.
It's lazy. That's exactly it, dude.
You know, it is lazy.
Lower the thing down, raise the legs a little bit, and set it up so that you have a stable platform. It doesn't make any sense to just crank that center column. It's like, it's physics, man. You're negating the whole point of using a tripod in the first place. It doesn't make any fucking sense. So anyway, that's Tony's rant for the week. Anybody got anything to add to that? I know we'll probably hear about this online and people will be like, well, it doesn't, my center column is sturdy as hell and has no movement in it and all this other shit. But I don't care what you say, man. Physics says that it's not as stable as shooting with
totally content. Especially even like when the mirror slaps, like I figure that my shit's pretty solid, but I auto align my images and even just that mirror slapping is going to move stuff, which isn't a problem anymore because I don't have a mirror in my new camera, which I get to try tomorrow for the first time. So I'm pretty pumped about that.
Duh, we're supposed to be talking about our thoughts on that camera tonight, so you're not gonna have a whole lot to add, are you?
Well, I put the battery in it, and
so you could talk about how easy it was to put the battery in or how difficult it was.
Yeah, I put the battery in and I screwed the my tripod plate onto the bottom of it, and that's about as far as I've gone with it. And but in my defense, I can't shoot without a remote trigger, and I like my old girls, my old RF602s, and I ordered the trigger cord from eBay, but it's not going to be here for another like 3 weeks. So I was prepared to use my 5D Mark II tomorrow, but I found this cord on Amazon, this adapter that seems to work. So I'm able to finally get that bad boy and do some shooting with it.
Wait, did you just say that you have a 5D Mark II?
I do. Yes,
that still works.
That's a number two.
Yes, yes, it has. I believe it's over 300,000 clicks or something. I did a shutter count on it recently, dude.
Didn't that come out in 2011 or something?
Oh, 2010? I believe it debuted in 2008.
Oh Jesus, no, it wasn't that long ago.
Yes, it was. I'm quite certain that it was. I mean, we could go to the Google machine, but I think it's 2000.
Ben, bring it up, dude. Bring it up. Let's see. When did that thing come out, man? I want to know. Acquiring minds want to know. While he's looking that up, I just want to tell everybody that if you follow us on social media, Pixel Punishers, on either Instagram or Twitter, you can get involved in the conversation because we will be including Q&As every week. And if you jump on either of those social media networks, you can give us your questions and we can answer them live on the show. They don't have to be photography related. They can be about anything. We have the Google machine. And if you just want to know where babies come from, Chase can probably look it up for you. So the three of us still haven't figured it out.
I could describe it too in visual detail. By the way, that Mark II, 2008.
Yes.
2008.
Jackpot.
All right.
Yeah.
Was Obama president in 2008?
I don't know who it might have been. Was Dubs, Sweet Dubs in there?
I don't know.
Who knows? I don't know. I don't know the math.
I don't remember, man. I don't know.
But either way, it's that is a brilliant piece of machinery, that 5D Mark II.
Why? Who cares who was president? What? Where does that come from? All right. Yeah, I had a 5D. So I got my first 5D Mark II. I won the – what was that magazine, Chase? Professional Photographer. Yeah, that's the PPA's mag they put out, Professional Photographer Magazine. I won the cover contest. Listen to this shit. So I didn't know you then, Barry, but – I have my studio down here, and I've only shot one senior session in my life. It was weird because they called me up, and the kid's mom was like, he wants you to shoot a senior session. And I'm like, I don't really do that. And he's like, but he wants you to do it in the studio on a white background. I'm like, I don't really do that. He really wants you to do it. Can we come in and talk to you? So they came in, and they sat down, and she showed me all these product photos. And I guess she wanted her son to look like a product. I don't know. But he had this idea to do all these retro-like coats with a boombox and retro glasses. Anyway, I shot the hell out of it. They turned out really cool. And then PPA had this contest for their cover contest. And they were like, hey, you can submit photos online for this. And I went, and you can see all the other submissions. People are submitting like fucking horizontal photographs for a cover contest. What kind of retard would submit?
You can just crop it.
Yeah, I guess that's what they were thinking, but some of them you couldn't. You'd crop out half the subject matter. So I thought, well, shit, I got a pretty good shot. At least mine's in vertical orientation. So I submitted this photo of the kid holding an iPhone out in front of him, and it was right in front of his face, and the iPhone was huge, and he was small in the background. The iPhone covered his whole face, but I had taken a picture of his face and dropped it onto the iPhone screen so that looked like what was there. You've seen that several times since, but I think I was the first person to do that.
That was the first original iPhone,
too. Yeah, it was iPhone 1. This was way back in the day, like 2008, 2007, something like that. So I submit, no, 2008. So I submitted the thing and I won. They called me and they were like, hey, you won this whole contest. And they sent me an Elenchrome lighting kit, a Ranger, 5D Mark II. They sent me like Gitzo tripods. I got $3,000 worth of lab credit at White House. I mean, just, it was like Christmas every day. And this was, you know, I was fairly new in Spokane. I was freaking out because I had all this cool shit coming. I couldn't hardly afford to buy a brand new 5D Mark II. And this one showed up in the mail with it. You know, I mean, this was amazing. And it did video. And I'm like, wow, video. And
do you have that 5D Mark II like enshrined in a glass case somewhere in the house?
No, dude. I probably threw it away. It's
come on.
It's an 11-year-old camera. Who's using that shit anymore?
I think you hawked it to get your D3 or whatever you had next, your Nikon. You switched to Nikon after that.
Yeah, well, you were with me then, right? Yeah, all right, so for those of you who don't know, Chase, who is our producer here, is my former assistant. He was an intern at the college here, a photo program, and he came on board as an intern, and he turned out to be a fucking badass. So I ended up hiring him, and he worked with me for several years. And I miss having him around and having Chase be able to, you know, I could just say, hey, Chase, here's something new I bought. Figure it out. Tell me how it works. Well, that's basically what happened here with this podcast is we got all this fancy podcast equipment and was like, I don't know how to use any of this. Hey, Chase, figure it out. So he was anxious to get back into something creative. So this gives us a chance to drink beer and play with cool tech on Sunday nights. So that's when we record this, by the way. So anyway, enough with my rant, enough with my story, my anecdote about the 5D Mark II. But I can't believe that your camera with 300,000 clicks.
It still works.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
Any issues with it at all?
Dude, the thing has it has been working flawlessly since day one, and I'm blown away. Like, the mirror is getting a little sluggish. She doesn't sound as healthy as she used to, but I actually did a shoot with it last week, and because I didn't have that shutter release cord for my EOS R, and she makes nice photos, man. She does nice work.
What about image quality? Have you ever had clients comment on that? People are always asking me, how do you get away? Like when I was shooting with the 1DX2, how do you get away with 20 megapixels? You know, but I'd never had any issues. Have you with the 5D2?
No way, man. Like if you look on our website and if you could tell me which photos were shot with a 1DX or a Mark IV or a Mark II, no one would ever know. Yeah. You know, so 20 megapixels is tons of resolution. I've never had anybody ask for something, you know, bigger. So
it's the glass. The glass makes the photo.
You put
Pro glass on a shitty T6 body, and it would look pretty damn good.
That Canon glass is damn nice. That's why I went back. You were saying I went to to Nikon for a while, but you know my history with Nikon. Remember drill pressing that wobbly ass fucking drill press
that was quite the sight to watch.
Oh my God, that's a whole nother podcast, but Jesus. So never again Nikon for me. Sorry Nikon. Never go back to Nikon. But you know, I moved back to Canon ultimately because that glass is so good. I mean, I even went to Sony for a while. I had phase one and I'm back to Canon. It's so good.
Yeah, I get tired of hauling around that Bentley everywhere you go.
I was noticing, I was online poking around a little bit, and I was in one of the forums, and someone was asking if they should get an A7 II or a 6D Mark II. And I said, why don't you consider the EOS R or the RP? And then for some reason, man, the Sony crowd, they're so loyal and they're so like rah rah for Sony. It's crazy. People just pop up in the comments and just write Sony and then they leave and they have no reason why.
Dude, they're like Texans. They fucking love that state. You know,
Nuts.
They get belt buckles and they put carvings above their fireplaces and shit. Sony people are the same way. I guarantee you, go in a Sony person's house, they got fucking Sony belt buckle on and they got posters of Sony in the garage. Dude, they're fanatics, man. I don't understand.
The end, too. I mean, Sony could go out and shoot somebody in the middle of the fucking street, and they would still buy their shit. They're
totally
fanatics.
They are totally.
They're like Apple almost.
And that's a good comparison. But I would do it for Apple. I mean, I love Apple everything. I'm using an Android right now as I say this, but
you're burning.
I know, but I had to try it out, man. I love tech that much, but they're fanatics. But I tell you what, Sony makes a good camera. I did a blog post. It's on the blog about Sony and why I went back to Canon and stuff. And really, it comes down to the color science, man. The Canon color is just so good, especially with auto white balance, white priority. That's worth the whole camera right there.
And the menus. And the menus are like...
Oh, yeah.
It's those Sony menus, like... I've never owned a Sony. I've assisted photographers that use the A7 R2 and the A7 R3. And I've never had – it's the least amount of fun I've ever had just trying to find a basic setting in a menu. And it's so funny that all these Sony people, they all buy these Sony bodies. And again, amazing sensors. And those cameras do kick a lot of ass. But for me, the deal breaker is definitely the menu. And then people are putting – everybody buys Canon glass for them anyways. So if Canon has better color science, better menus – and again, we're talking about image quality. You would never know the difference looking what was shot on an A7 R3 or an EOS R or any other camera. So I don't understand, you know, why they're so loyal and so fanatical about it. I don't get it. So hopefully somebody can chime in and like I would love to hear why personally.
Yeah, hit us up. So that brings me to the next topic, pixelpunishers.com. Is the website we have set up for this. It's basically a blog style website, and we'll be posting every one of these episodes there, and it'll have the show notes as well as links to anything we talk about and promo codes if we have any for the particular products we're talking about. So definitely check out pixelpunishers.com and leave comments either on social media at Pixel Punishers, Instagram or Twitter, or on the website in the comments for the blog, and let us know, you know, why Sony? Why so dedicated to Sony? I mean, again, I had one. Here's the thing about Sony. I give it to them for pushing the industry, right? They came out with this mirrorless camera that was affordable and it had tons of features. I mean, if you're doing video and stills, it was hard to beat for a long time, right?
Yeah.
And you know, the focus peaking, and you grab that focus ring and it immediately jumps into like that, real tight focus, I forget what they call it, but it's like precision focus or something like that, where it zooms in all of a sudden so you can dial in your focus really easily. A lot of cool features that it had. Of course, it was mirrorless and you got the EVF and all of that. But I tell you who did a nice job right out of the gate is Canon. So Barry and I both have the Canon EOS R. And dude,
it took them so long to get that out, though.
I know, but they did a nice job for their first entry into the market. They really did.
I think really what that was, though, they designed that. I mean, that's a new mount. That's an entirely new mount. That's what they're going forward with.
Yeah, the RF mount.
That was the icing on the cake was that.
Barry was here when I got mine, and you've got yours now. But like you said, you've put the battery in. You're going to use it this week to shoot. But, man, I got to say, and I think Barry would agree, the kit lens, the RF 24-105 f4, is sharper than any EF glass that I owned. And I had all the L lenses, basically.
Yeah, hands down. And the build quality is so nice on those RF lenses. It's insane. Oh, all of them. And then you have that 28-70, and that thing literally is the easily the nicest lens in terms of just the way it, like, that thing's a piece of art just to look at.
So big. Chase saw it yesterday for the first time and was like,
I held it in my hands. God. I wanted to stuff it in my pants and run away.
Yeah, it's dude, serious.
That thing is a monster. I absolutely have no use for that glass, but it was just so sexy I couldn't resist. So
could work out with it.
Dude, I tell you what, though, the focus distance on that thing, minimum focus distance, was like
5 or 6 inches.
It's super. Yeah, they claim it's, see what it says. I forget what it says, but bring it up, Chase. And they say it's like 0.9 or 1 foot or something like that. But I'm telling you, you can get closer than that. It's really, really close. So
is it a 24 to 70?
It's a 28 to 70. RF 28 to 70. Yeah, the RF mount. So my opinion is these RF lenses are sharper than anything Canon has in their arsenal. So I sold all my EF lenses except for the tilt shifts. Yeah, because, you know, it's going to be 10 years before we see tilt shifts on this RF mount, unfortunately. So I have to keep that adapter. But the nice thing about the adapter is it's just a dumb adapter. All it does is give you the right spacing between the sensor and the lens, you know. So, and I, you know, I have the Mark II 24 and the 17 and the 50 is brand new, and they're all really sharp. So I don't have a problem with the image quality there. And the EOS R is not a high megapixel sensor. So what do you think about the resolution on it? What do you think about 30 or 32 megapixels or something?
Yeah, it's like 30.6 or something. I think that's perfect. I mean, I think the megapixel race, I thought that was over when the DA50 came out. And then, of course, the 5DSR came out with 50 megapixels. And now those phase backs are ridiculous. And they're talking about the next version of the EOS R being 100 megapixels. Like, I don't want those files. I don't want to work with those files. I don't want to get 36 images on a 64 gig card. Like, I think it's getting into him personally. I think that anywhere between 20 and 30 is the sweet spot for me personally. I don't know. Like, I don't do a ton of cropping after the fact. So I get that part of it. If you have those extra pixels where you can do some cropping, but man, 100 megapixels, that's insanity.
Yeah. It's unnecessary, really. I mean, I know there's people out there that want it. But I don't have a problem with the images that I'm capturing. Okay, I think 30, 32, 35 is the sweet spot right in there. Nikon got it right when they came out the D800 at 32 megapixels or whatever it was. It's such a beautiful camera that, you know, everything right about it. It's got good color. It's got great resolution. The problem is I don't like Nikon. So, you know, now that Canon has this EOS R that came out mirrorless at 30, whatever it is, I think it's perfect, man. I absolutely love that resolution. It's just enough to give me all the detail I need, but not so big that I have to buy a new computer because it's bogging the thing down, you know?
Yeah. And the other thing about the EOS R with the RF to EF adapter, I put it on the body tonight for the first time. And like, it fits snug and nice. It's just so nice that it's first party. It's not some shitty third party Chinese thing that's all janky and loose. Like, it's a it fits on that mount so well. And then I put the 24 tilt shift on just to see. And I like it, man. I think it's nice. I have no issues with it. Again, I've never shot with it, but just the way that it feels, like, it feels nice and like the mount's nice and tight. It's not wobbly. So.
Well, yeah. I mean, you remember when we were in Arizona and we were playing with Rain and Ryan's Fuji, right? And they have that adapter on there. It's a Cambo adapter on the thing to use the Canon lenses. That thing's the biggest piece of shit you got to recharge it. You can't see what aperture you're at. You're wiggling behind it trying to see. It's got this little display on it. I mean, it's a horrible thing. I have to mess with that. I'm so happy that Canon created this adapter and they released it at the same time. I think that might have been half my problem with the Sony is I had to use the Metabones adapter to use my EF lenses. I think that was causing some IQ issues. I was never happy with the IQ on the Sony with the Canon tilt shift lenses when I was out shooting architecture. If I zoomed in to 100%, I could see artifacting around all the edges of the buildings and things like that. I just never loved it. So that's one of the reasons I sold it. But I haven't experienced any of that with this EOS R. I absolutely love the thing. I'm blind as a fucking bat. So being able to see, you know, that's age, dude. I can't, my arms aren't long enough to get the thing away anymore. So I can't, being able to see that top display, it's, I think it's a backlit thing, that top LCD, but when you press it, it goes from a black background and white letters to a white background and black letters. So I can actually see the settings of the camera, and they made it large too. So you can see like F8 or whatever you're at, which is really nice. The other thing is with the EVF, when you're looking through the thing, you can turn that new ring they have on the end, the whatever it's called, the
control ring.
The control ring, yeah. And you can change your ISO. You can program that thing up. I mean,
that's pretty slick.
It is really cool. And you see all that through the viewfinder, you know. And because you're looking through an EVF, it's a what you see, a WYSIWYG, if you will, viewfinder. So you see exactly what you're going to get out of the thing, which is amazing, which, okay, Sony has and all the other, you know, mirrorless have that. But what I'm saying is Canon did a really nice entry into the mirrorless market. And I think that the new one they came out with, what is it, the ESRP, just as good. They took a few features off to make it cheaper. It doesn't have the top display. It's a little bit smaller, et cetera, et cetera. But also a nice camera. The only reason I didn't buy it is because it uses a different battery. And I have all these Canon batteries, you know, that fit the EOS R. And I didn't want to have to buy a whole bunch of other batteries. So what did you find out about minimum focus distance?
It says 15 inches, but I don't know.
There's no way. It wasn't 15 inches, dude.
I don't know. Maybe it's 70 millimeter. I don't know.
That's like bar talk. It's 15 inches.
It's 15.
It's really 6 inches. Yeah. So, yeah, that's bullshit. It's better than that. They're being conservative. But that 28 to 70 is sweet. It's huge. And a wedding shooter would not want to lug that thing around. God, no. There's no way.
You'd have cramps.
You definitely need the grip on that body to use that lens, because it would be like tipped up. It's bigger than the size of the body, right?
It's right about the same. Yeah. It's, I mean, heavy, I have the grip on the EOS R, and I mean, with that lens and the grip and everything on there, it's a beast, man. It's like carrying around my 1DX2 with a 70 to 200 on it.
Yeah, the Sirius.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm happy with it, man. I've really liked it. The only issue I had with it,
the price.
No, not the lens. Yeah, lens is stupid expensive. What is it? $3,000, dude. It was stupid, but it was an impulse buy. It was a total impulse buy.
Fuck you. You can have a $3,000 impulse buy. Fuck you. I got to talk to my wife about a $3,000 purchase.
The camera itself, the only issue I had when it came out was that you could not charge it through the USB while tethered. So the Sony, if you tether to my laptop, it would actually pull juice from the laptop and it would charge the camera. So if I plugged my laptop in, the camera would be charging. I never had to change batteries, right? Mm-hmm. Which is one of the reasons I went to the 1DX2, because it has that monster Canon battery and I never hardly ever had to change batteries. But now that I'm back to a mirrorless and then the EOS R, I can't charge. So there's a workaround with the grip. I can plug their AC adapter into the grip and charge the camera, and I can tether out of the main USB port on the camera. But I don't want to have to plug all that extra shit in. I just want to be able to come right off the laptop. So what I used to do with the Sony is plug like an anchor battery into the laptop and then plug the camera into the laptop, and the camera and the laptop would always be charged throughout a shoot. Barry, you mentioned something about a firmware update that may allow that. Is that something confirmed or just rumor?
Yeah, that was a rumor that was going to happen, USB-C charging, because I think the firmware comes out this week, and it's got like eye autofocus detection, I think, is coming out, and there's some like back-end firmware stability thing, but I don't think there's any USB-C on this next firmware that's coming out this week. I think it's on the 18th that comes out.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on it, but that would be, that's my only complaint about the thing. I want to be able to charge it while I'm shooting. Cause I carry around those external battery packs on location, and, you know, I strap them on the bottom of my DigiPlate or whatever, so that I'm completely wireless moving around. I'm not tethered to anything that's not connected to my tripod, but, having to plug the thing in to charge it or swap batteries. One of the reasons I bought the grip was because I can put two batteries in the thing now and I hardly have to change the batteries. So, but I would like to be able to charge it through that USB-C port. And just to say thank you for putting a USB-C port on the thing and not USB 3.0. Freaking hate that cheap connection.
Always it's the jankiest shit ever. It looks like somebody just took a pair of needle nose and pinched it and then It's silly, man.
It went in like an eighth of an inch into your camera. It always felt like it was about to fall out. What a piece of shit garbage that was. I'm glad that was short-lived. This USB-C is always a nice connection. And you don't, I mean, it only goes in one way. So if you're blind like I am, you can, it doesn't matter which way you're putting a thing in there, you know? As long as you hit the right hole.
Indeed.
Oh, I got something for that.
Do
I got
you?
Something for that. Yeah. Yeah. Play.
What is your favorite hole?
The ladies, man. Oh, shit. I got my kvassi. Oh, man. We got to get more sound bites going. This is episode one, folks. So
I'm out of the loop. I don't hear the sound bites on my end. So you guys are enjoying all that great fun over there. And I got
you'll
nothing.
Have to listen for 30 minutes through the next recording just to hear it.
Perfect.
You have to play this back. Yeah. Okay. So ESR, what's your take, Barry?
Man, I don't have anything other than the battery fits real nice and the adapter fits real nice. That's all I got for this week. But so, next week I'll have two full shoots with it, so we can revisit this on next week's episode, and hopefully I'll have a bit more of an opinion and some feedback.
Talk to me about the price. So you're in Canada. Where did you buy it?
I bought it through Vistech, and my buddy works there, so I got a bit of a break on the price, but I think it still ended up costing with tax and shipping and everything. It was like $4,600 Canadian for the kit.
Oh God. What is the retail on it?
Oh, I have no idea. Five? It's probably close to that. Oh, it's, man, God. We get crushed up here. Like, and then again, I sold my MacBook Pro and I got to buy a new MacBook Pro. And the one I'm looking at is like 4K plus tax. It's going to be like $4,600. And that's like, not even a good one. That's with like 16 gigs of RAM and a 512 hard drive. And it's going to be, you know, same price, $4,600. So it's tough up in Canada, man.
Just take a trip down to Oregon. You don't have no sales tax and you get American prices.
Yeah, but he has to smuggle it up his ass on the way home.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, man. I don't know if there's enough lube to get a 15-inch MacBook.
You might have to go for the 13-inch.
Should I Google how much lube does it take?
Oh, my God. That sucks, dude. That's brutal. You know, here in the U.S., the body is $2,299, so $2,300, which I think is very reasonable for a body. You know, they're saying a pro body is coming, but this is everything I need in a camera. I don't understand why it would be more pro than this.
Probably the speed and weather sealing, I think, are really the only things that – that could make it better.
Yeah, I guess. And you know, it's so specific to the genre that you're working in, because what we do, I don't need weather sealing necessarily, and I don't
need
8
frames per second shooting. That's it.
Well, I mean,
for a mirror, I mean, Sony's like 20 or something like that.
I don't know, look it up, man. Just spout shit out. So yeah, I don't know. I don't have any need to shoot any faster than that.
Well, I mean, for mirrorless, you think it'd be up a little bit.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Sony just came out with one not too long ago.
High-speed continuous shooting up to 20 frames per second.
What is that, though? That's an A9?
A9.
Oh, 20 frames a second. Jesus.
That's insanity.
Their sports version. Yeah, so Canon will get there. Like I said, this is their entry into it, and I think they did a damn nice job. Sony, obviously the leader in mirrorless right now, which is what's waking everybody else up. I mean, Canon and Nikon both introduced at the same time, and I think it's only going to get better from here. So this is the way it's going. I've been talking to reps. I've been talking to people. This is the way everything is going, is mirrorless. So I think the 1DX Mark III is coming out, which will still be an SLR, but it's going to – that'll be it. And then I think it's going everything mirrorless after that. So they're putting all their eggs in this basket moving forward. So I would tell people, which is the same thing I did – sell your EF lenses now while you can still get some decent money before the market gets flooded with them and it just drives the price down. You know, I'm waiting on the 15 to 35 and the 70 to 200.
Yeah. Is there any word on a 70 to 200?
It is. It's coming. Yeah. 70 to 200 2.8 IS. The problem is
it'd be $4,000.
No, they're not internal focusing. It's short, stubby little thing. It's like, it's the size of my 28 to 70. It's about that big around and about that tall, but it doesn't have internal focusing, so it sticks out. Yeah,
like
the 28 to 70 does, which drives me nuts. But otherwise, you'd have this big long lens, which I'm fine with having a longer lens because at least I know how long it is all the time. I'm not near something and then bonk, you know, you slam into a fence while you're trying to take pictures of your kid at soccer or something because the lens extends 3 inches out the front of the camera, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm not crazy about that, but I'm going to get it because I want to go all RF mount. I want to eliminate the adapter as much as possible.
You got that itch, don't you?
The itch?
The itch for the gear upgrade. You're always itchy.
The rash. You're not talking about that.
Check out what I got.
I got the goods, man.
You say something about the RF, the way that the flange or something is on the RF, that they're able to basically put the elements in reverse, or they're developing them a certain way that makes them like superior to how they're making EF?
Yes.
Was it you telling me that?
Yeah, it was. I talked to one of the reps from Leica or something. Evidently, Leica's been doing this for years, and Canon is doing it with the RF now. They're building the lenses with reverse elements or something like that, and I forget what the advantage was now. It's been a few weeks since I talked to him. I forgot what I told you, but whatever I told you was out of the horse's mouth, essentially. There was an advantage to putting the elements in reverse. So Chase is going to look it up. Anyway, we'll come back to that. So price, you're paying a fortune for it up there. We're paying better prices down here. Build quality, what are your first impressions, Barry?
I think it's great, man. I have zero complaints with it. I honestly, it's a great little camera. Like I do not miss the Mark IV at all.
You had the Mark IV. I had the Mark IV. This is basically a Mark IV processor, or a Mark IV sensor with a faster processor.
Yeah. And then the CR through the CR3 files are super, super nice.
Yeah. Yeah. You edited some of my stuff that I shot on it for me. And, you wrote me, I think I posted that screenshot online. It was like, holy shit, these are far and away better than the Mark IV files or the 1DX2 files, which is saying something. So I'm pretty happy with the noise handling on this. I wasn't with the Mark IV so much, and I don't know if it was just a bad unit. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't really notice an improvement over my – this is going to sound funny again – over my Mark II, which debuted in 2008 and it's running on diesel fuel – I did not notice a quality difference between the Mark II and the Mark IV in terms of anything across the board. I didn't notice better noise performance than my Mark II. Maybe my Mark II is like a unicorn and it was like a Mark IV and a Mark II's body that traveled back in time. I don't know. Because
that had to be it.
It has to be.
That's funny, dude. All right, so I think that's enough on the Canon EOS R. I like it. We'll check back with you next week after you've had a chance to shoot with yours. So for those people listening, our attempt is to do this podcast every week. So we'll get together Sunday nights, drink a couple beers, do an hour of recording, and then on our way. So we'll check back and see what Barry's thoughts are next week. Because it's our first episode and we don't have any sponsors, let's sponsor ourselves, Barry. What do we have happening in May?
We have a little workshop coming up in May, and we're doing that down in Scottsdale, Arizona, down in the desert with the rattlesnakes and the scorpions. And we're, I think, 2 seats are left now. We have 10 of 12 sold.
Nice.
So if you want to get in on that, I mean, we're going to be making photographs, and we're going to be swearing and drinking, and that's pretty much all we're going to be doing. I mean,
that's it.
I mean, I don't know how good my sales pitch is, but it's going to be fucking awesome. It's going to be epic. So
talk about the place that we got going on. How many places are we shooting? What are they going to learn? Let's talk about all that good stuff.
So we've lined up a sweet mid-century Airbnb that we're going to be shooting at, and I believe we're staying in that one as well.
Is it mid-century? Mid-century. You're right. Mid-century.
Sorry, man. And it's cool. There's going to be a good opportunity to make some nice portfolio images in there. The kitchen's super cool. It's very bright and light, the house, but it's got this sort of navy blue kitchen, which is really cool. And then what we're going to do is if and when the workshop sells out and we get those other 2 seats sold, we're going to basically ask the attendees, you know, here's 10 potential homes that we're looking at, which one we're going to take a vote and book that second house based on feedback from the people that are coming to the workshop. So that should be good, man. I'm pumped for it. I love teaching. I mean, it's looks like we got a good group already, so hopefully we can fill those last 2 spots. And I'm going to make Bloody Marys. I'm going to show people how to do the best cannonball ever, too. So,
oh, yeah, there's a pool at the place, yeah.
Yeah, bring your trunks, and I'll show you how to do a world-class cannonball.
Nice. Yeah, so we've done them down there before, yeah? And they've always worked out well. Arizona, Scottsdale especially, nice place. Weather's always good. You know, we'll get Rain or Ryan out there for the rap party to hang out. I'm sure we got some fans of those guys in there. They're the best, and that's one of the reasons we like to do these workshops in places where we have friends, because we get to hang out and see people we don't normally get to see very often. So I think you can hit up just about anybody from our previous workshops, and they will all tell you that you're getting your value for the things. And we got some promo codes, so hit us up on DM or whatever. We'll get you $250 off. What else? Oh, the private Facebook group. So once you do a workshop with us, you get access to a private Facebook group where you can hit us up anytime. If you have questions about pricing or a particular scenario with a client, or you need feedback on an image or whatever, Barry and I are in there to help you until one of us dies. Or until Facebook folds, whichever one comes first.
So, it could be next year.
Yeah. So we got, but you get access to that. And, you know, we have people from the previous workshops from years ago that still will throw a question in there once in a while, and we do our best to answer it. So what else?
Yeah. And then on top of the actual workshop too, I mean, we talked about doing some one-to-one stuff with people. So, you know, if people want to bring their portfolio, a printed portfolio, or if they just want us to rip their website apart over beers, we're going to do that. And so on top of just the, you know, going through our actual process, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have seen either one of ours or both of our tutorials on Pro EDU. So it's a good opportunity if you've watched those and there's ever been anything not entirely clear to see it in person and stop us right, you know, mid process and say, you know, why are you doing that? And it's just that one-to-one time is going to be huge as well. So
yeah, that's the deal with this. I mean, people that have bought the tutorials have DM me and they're like, why should I come to the workshop if I already have the tutorial? Well, that's why, because the workshop is a one-way communication. This is two-way. So you can stop Barry and I mid process or pull us to the side and ask questions or whatever. This is a chance to interact directly while we're there. We can walk you through and show you anything you may be struggling with, as well as Barry said, after hours, we'll be doing portfolio reviews and one-on-one coaching, things like that. This is all part of the workshop. We're not charging extra for that stuff. So we really care about this. We don't make a ton of money on these things, you know. We're going to see our friends. We're going to hang out. We're going to pay our expenses. We'll come home with a few bucks, but you know, the tutorials is the same way. I want to make sure that the good information is getting out there. There's so much noise on YouTube these days with just shit information flowing through the airwaves that it's nice to be able to actually put out information based on our experience and not just regurgitating stuff that other people are talking about. And so that's what Barry and I are bringing to the table here is real life experiences. And if you ask us a question about a scenario that we haven't encountered, that's what we're going to tell you is like, I've never encountered that. This is what I would do. Don't know if that's the right answer or not, but that's what we would do. So anyway, check it out. Run over to rosalindmckenzie.com and click on the EDU link and scroll down to workshops. You can read all about the workshop. You can register for it. Hit us up on social media for $250 off. We'll give you a coupon code, and we'll see you in Arizona in May.
Indeed.
Right. What is next, dude? Q&A? You want to do some Q&A?
Sure, man.
Yeah, we've got some people that have been asking questions on the Twitters and the twits, if you will call them.
Have you been getting twatted at?
I've been getting all kinds of twats coming in here. So
dang.
We got, and I'm not going to call anybody's name out. I'm just going to talk about the questions. But number one, you both got the Canon EOS R. What are the main reasons for the upgrade?
Well, we kind of already covered that, but
I don't know if we did really. We talked about why we like it, but why did you decide to upgrade to the EOS R?
I don't know if it was a direct upgrade or just a switch, but I was never in love with my Mark IV. So that was the big motivator for me was after seeing you. I mean, Tony bought his while we were riding up a chairlift in Idaho. He's like, I'm going to buy a camera right now. And I'm like, okay, that sounds about right. So he had it like overnighted. And yeah, it's like
impulse buy.
Yeah, it was impulse. You know, we had 5 minutes to kill on a chairlift, so why not buy a camera? And then just to having a chance to get my hands on it for that short amount of time at the studio. I was thinking, you know, not being in love with that Mark IV, maybe this is the direction to go, because that's their current, that's the latest and greatest, right? So, and I didn't want to go to a 5DSR or something like that again, because I don't need the megapixels. So it just seemed like the right move. And again, that RF glass and that new mount, like all that stuff, it just, it's amazing. And like you said earlier, that's the direction Canon's headed. So I kind of want to be on board for that. How about you, Tony?
Yeah. Early adoption is my thing. You know that. So that was a big deal, is the latest and greatest, but also USB-C. I hate USB 3 with a passion. So USB-C was a deal. EVF was a nice thing to add. Focus peaking, because I'm blind and I can never tell what's in focus. So being able to have it all go red when whatever I want in focus is in focus. The glass and the sharpness is so good. You know, it's everything about it, I just like a little bit better than what I had before. So it was worth going, because I know I'm going to do it anyway. The transition was inevitable. So I just jumped for it. And so far I'm really happy that I did. So I have a few shoots this week with it, and you know, we'll see how that goes. But so far I got no negatives with the thing. I really like it. I really like it. So if anybody's on the fence about buying one, I would say
I'm on the fence.
Are you?
Yeah.
Are you thinking about buying one?
Maybe. If they would have released it when I bought a 60 Mark II, I would have probably.
Don't you have the 1DX Mark III or the 1D no. Mark III or whatever it's called?
Well, I have the old 1D yeah. Mark III, yeah.
Well, which is as good as his 5D2. What the
Why? But wait, why are you talking in that tone about the 5D Mark II?
But I would. I would probably. I mean, I'd like to get my hands on one and play with it.
Well, there's one here. You can get your hands on mine anytime you want, buddy. Yeah. All right. So I think that pretty much tells people what we're about with that. So let's move on. Next question. Money question. How much do you charge to have somebody pixel punish your images, or where do you find people to help you do, say, 8 to 15 images? Craigslist. Broad question, trying to find help in the future. So Chase would go to Craigslist, and there's plenty on there.
Oh,
and,
God,
and you can see their samples. It's wonderful.
Oh.
Are there retouchers on Craigslist?
Oh, there's photographers and retouchers, and I mean, that, everything. That's where I found Chase.
Oh,
fuck you.
No, there are, really. I mean, it's funny. Actually, if you go on there and search for photographers or something, bring it up, Chase. Let's look. I wish we could share this. We're going to have to start doing video on these podcasts just so people can see what we're looking at. But go on there and search retouching or photography.
That's good.
Okay. And, oh, my God, it's amazing. Some of the stuff you see, they're offering sessions in the park, and all they have in their portfolio is, like, pictures of plants and shit or flowers, you know, I mean, whatever, but it's absolutely amazing. So, but that's not where I would find my retoucher. What was the question? How much do you charge to have somebody punish? So I don't charge anything. They charge me, but I know what he means. So anywhere from, this is funny because I reached out, 2 years ago about looking for a retouch? Last year? Was it last year? I don't remember, but I reached out recently, last 24 months, looking for a retoucher on Instagram. And I had people from all over the world responding. And they were all skill levels, from newbies that were like, hey, I'm new at this, but I think I'm really good. I would love an opportunity, to people who have been doing this for years. And so I had the same sample images, and I sent to everybody, and just to see what they came back with. The funny part is that some of the newer people came back with amazing results. And I'm like, how much would you charge? And I'm like, $11, you know? It's like, holy shit. You're undercharging, you know? And then others that didn't do so well would come back and say $2.50 an hour or something. And I'm like, well, how long did you spend on this? Well, about 3 hours. Well, Jesus Christ, $7.50 an image. How am I going to make any money, you know?
Yeah.
So it was all over the map, is my point. And what I found to be the most common, though, is somewhere in the $75 to $150 an image range for what we do for architecture. And I think that's what they're asking about here. Obviously, that's our genre. So for that kind of editing, the editors that I've run into, I pay anywhere from $75 to $150 an image. And 100 being the median in there somewhere, is about $100 an image, which is about what I charge my clients. So it's really a pass-through cost for me. I'm going to get as many images done in the day as I can, but I'm not going to be motivated by trying to get more images so I can make more money, which is good and bad. I mean, my clients see that and they go, okay, so he's not going to push us towards crappy shots, just trying to build the shot list. But at the same time, he doesn't have motivation to work super fast and get a ton of images. But I think it toes that line right in the middle where, you know, I'm going to do the best I can in the day for you, because I have no motivation here to inflate the cost. You know, it's a pass-through cost to my editor. And Barry, for those of you who have seen our tutorials, Barry, when he has the opportunity, edits a lot of the photos that I shoot. And they're not easy. They're not super difficult. Some of them are, but a lot of them aren't super. I mean, they're average. They're middle of the road. Chase has edited a bunch of my photos in the past. Yeah. And, you know, $100, reasonable fee, would you say, or no? Is it? What do you think, Barry?
Yeah. I mean, there's certain times where I'm retouching an image and it's smooth sailing, and I'm like, oh, that was quick and easy money. But there's other times where I'm dying and I'm cursing, and I guess it comes out in the wash. So you just got to know your value and basically, you know that there are going to be photos that kick the shit out of you, and there's going to be some that are easy. And at the end of the day, you know, it should all balance out. But yeah, that's that price range. Like, I'd be curious to know what a place like House Tribeca charges. Like, they do all Scott Francis's work. Like, are they $250 an image? Are they $500? I have no idea. But I'd be curious actually to know that. So if anybody knows, you know, what the rate is at a retouching house like that, I'd love to know.
Yeah. I mean, and if it's super expensive, I have no reason to hire them, though, is the thing, because I can have phenomenal retouchers like you, or I can reach out on the gram and have, you know, 30 people respond and get somebody for $11 a photo. The reason I don't go with somebody like that is because it's not sustainable. There's no way that guy's going to continue doing edits for me at that, you know, and that's pretty much what I wrote him back and said, hey, dude, you know, you did a great job. I don't know how long this took you. It looks fantastic, but there's no way you can charge $11 for this moving forward, you know? So,
yeah, I'm such a control freak that I retouch all my own stuff, and I've set myself up that I don't shoot a crazy amount of volume where I can't handle it. So, I mean, I don't want to shoot every day. I only want to shoot like 30, 40 projects a year. And it's funny, I've only actually reached out for retouching one time, and it was a commercial exterior, and they had redone the sidewalk, and it was all ripped up, and there was pylons and tarps and shit everywhere. So I reached out to, like, you know, I'm sure that a lot of our listeners get spammed daily by retouchers who want to earn your business. So I went through my spam folder and I picked out like 10 of these retouching places, and I sent them this photo and I said, this is for an important client. It has to be done well. So put your best editor on it. And it's like, yeah, just like you said, you send it and you see what you get back, and just the degree of how different they all were. And then, you know, I ripped it apart. I said, this is dog shit, man. Like, you guys did a horrible job here. And they're like, well, we didn't put our best editor on that. Let me put our best editor on it. And so they put their best editor on it, and I think it was even shittier than the other one. So I was like, I don't trust anybody to do my, and that's a big thing too. I was talking to my friend last week. He teaches at the college here, and I went to have a lunch and a beer with him, and I checked out the studio at the college, and he was asking about retouching, and he was saying that you know what just happened? The train just went off the rails, and I forget what I was fucking talking about.
Jesus Christ.
Jesus.
Oh my God.
No, let me circle back around here. Everything was going so well.
It's Steven.
Oh, the train is right off the fucking rails. Eggs and juice? Yeah, so everything was going so well. No, what was he saying with the retouching?
Well, you were talking about your buddy at the college and retouching. Yeah. And so what, did he have a bad experience with it?
Or? Yes. Now I remember where the train's back on the rails now. So he was telling me that he had tried outsourcing some of his retouching, and he said that every photo he got back, he would have to spend an hour just fixing shit. So he's like, it's silly that I am sending this stuff out, getting it back, and then basically redoing it from scratch anyways. So, I think for like photos that aren't like high value, like there's a lot of real estate shooters that are more or less camera operators, and they spray and pray, and then they send the shit to get retouched. And they don't care how it comes back. But like, if something's not quite right, I don't want to have to fix that. I'd rather just do it from the start and know that it's going to be right the first time, you know?
Yeah. Well, here's my take on all of that. So as you know, I've changed genres a few times. When I was doing product, if it was for a big client or a food shoot, you know, where we brought in a stylist and stuff, I definitely farmed that out. I farmed it out to a high-end retoucher. That's worked into the price. That's, you know, the client has a budget for a stylist. They certainly have a budget for retouching. Same way with product. You know, if it was a high-end product shoot and we had a good budget, I would farm it out to a retoucher. With architecture, I don't know. Because we shoot in such a composite scenario and architecture, it's hard to tell a retoucher what it is that you're wanting from the photos, you know, which is why I tend to gravitate.
So give them like 30, 40 elements.
Right. Which is why I tend to gravitate towards other architecture photographers to edit my images, because they kind of see it, they get it, you know?
I know for you, a lot of the retouching I do for you, when we first started working together and I was doing your retouching, you used to have to call images down and give me an idea of what each file is for. Now you just send me basically a batch of raws, and I can quickly and easily scroll through them in Lightroom and be like, oh yeah, that's for this. This is for that. That's for this. So once you have that working relationship, but yeah, you're right. If you know, because our shooting style it's different, but there's enough similarities that I know exactly what you're going for when I look at your captures. So that makes the process a lot easier. There's no back and forth.
Definitely. And I think it's important to try somebody out. I mean, any retoucher worth their salt is going to try an image out so that you can see what the results are going to be, and you can see if it's a result that you're going for. You know, so I would say don't just blindly throw all your images at a retoucher in hopes that they're going to come back with good images, because you could end up wasting a bunch of time. You get a bunch of shit back and you're at square one, you know. The other thing I use retouchers for is KOs, man. I don't KO mm-hmm. shit. I mean, you can send that off to – I use Clipping Paths Asia, and it's 80 cents a photo to have it KO'd. I don't do that for architecture, but all the product stuff, the catalog stuff, any of the food stuff, any of that I need KO'd, I send it to them. They get it back in 24 hours for 80 cents a photo. I can't.
You're spending a week doing it yourself.
Yeah, right? At least a couple hours trying to cut stuff out. They do it. I mean, I just send it at the end of the shoot. At the end of the day, I go home. I come back the next morning, and it's back. And cheap. It's perfect. And you zoom in, and they're going around fibers on stuff. And you're like, holy crap, man. You know, it's amazing, and it's super cheap. So I tell you who not to use, Barry.
You do not want to use Clipping Bees, because they'll steal your credit card.
Do not use Clipping Bees. Sorry if you're listening, Clipping Bees, but somebody's got a hold of your email or your servers, or it's you guys or whatever. But I used to recommend them, but we found out three of us had our credit cards stolen. We all used Clipping Bees, and it was a big yeah. We finally narrowed it down to them.
Some guys in India you can't do really anything about.
Yeah, the nice thing was they had such a good interface. Their GUI was really easy to use. Sure, you could go in the back end, you could see like all your past jobs and download. It didn't feel hodgepodge together, which all of the other ones do. But they did they stole your credit card.
They stole your fucking money.
Yeah.
It was driving me crazy.
We look good.
I went through like 8 credit cards in 6 months. It was driving me nuts, dude. Yeah, I was going to like restaurants and screaming at waiters and shit. And like, oh, I'm sorry, it wasn't you. Oh. So anyway, let me see if we have more questions. I'm pretty sure we do. So what sort of editing do you do in Lightroom before sending it to Photoshop?
What I do in Lightroom is I always click the auto button. That's the first thing I do. I just want to see. I'm curious what it's going to give me. So it usually does the same shit. It jacks the highlights, it jacks the shadows, drops the highlights. So it's weird. Every sort of update of Lightroom, it's been getting worse and worse. But that was my go-to, is just clicking auto to see what it was going to give me. And I do all my importing through there. So I'll do lens correction. If you're out there and you're not doing lens corrections, like that is the lowest hanging fruit.
Yes.
Scroll down.
It's a click.
You can set it to do it when you import. You don't even have to think about it. But there's people out there with CA all over their photos, and barrel distortion,
vignette,
and then yeah, and you point it out, and they're like, get all defensive. It's like, man, just fucking click the button. Click the button. So yeah, I do the lens corrections. I see what auto does. I pump up the clarity a little bit, and other than that, I sometimes will tweak the white balance, but I find that my white balance is usually pretty good, and then I just load stuff as a stack and then export it over to Photoshop. How about you, Tony?
You know, people are surprised in the workshops and in the tutorial and stuff at how little raw conversion I do, but I used to go through all of that, and they want to know, what's the best raw conversion software? Well, I think that Capture One is better than Lightroom. I really do. It creates a better image. It's sharper. The colors are better, etc. The problem is that Lightroom is just faster, man. It's more intuitive. It's faster. It's easier for me to use. And so I just throw them in the Lightroom now, and I don't do that much raw conversion. I'll do the CA, and I'll do some straightening or some lens correction, something like that. And then I'll bring it into Photoshop and do the rest in there. I don't do a lot of pushing and pulling in raw conversion, and I probably should. It's just that clients want more and more and more images these days, faster and faster and faster. So I want to get it into Photoshop and start editing as quick as I can. I don't know. It's probably the wrong approach, but it's what I've been doing. So
I do want to learn Capture, and this winter my intention was to learn Capture, but I got busy and I didn't get around to it. But it's insane, like to jump on some Facebook groups or to poke around and see how much people are pulling shit. Like there's people, I remember I saw this in when I was trying to promote my real estate photography tutorial. I was in the Facebook groups, and people are posting screenshots of their like secret sauce, and it's like highlight slider at 100%, shadow slider at 100%, and then they have the exposure bumped by 3.5 stops, and it's like noise reduction at 100%. I'm like, man, you're not doing your job capturing these photos. I mean, if you're pulling 3 stops of light and having to like pull every slider to 100, you need to rethink how you're shooting stuff. That's my opinion. I think that's insane, man, because those images on a phone or on an MLS listing might look fine, but those things are going to fall apart, you know, on a full screen on an iMac or in print. And I don't know, man. I think that people get lazy, and maybe they don't understand the triangle and how to get a proper exposure. But, you know, the sliders are there for a reason, but they're not ever supposed to be pushed to 100.
No.
That's my opinion anyways, man.
that's crazy, man. You know, I like the fact that my cameras can pull 3 stops if I need it, you know, but I'm not relying on that as my special sauce, you know. It's if you need it, you like find an area in a photo that's super dark. You're like, wow, there's no detail over here underneath this, you know, whatever table or something, a chair or something that you want to show some detail, and you can pull it back if you need to. But to rely on that with sliders and your raw conversion and trying to pull it that far, yeah, you're missing the mark in camera. I mean, take a couple more shots, change your settings a little bit, try to get it right. I think that has a lot to do with everybody that buys a camera and decides they're going to be a professional photographer, and they build a website, and you know they're done.
And they put that center column up too. They jack that center column up.
That's why they're putting a center column up. Yeah, they're just fucking lazy, man. You know, go work for somebody. Be an assistant. Be an intern. Be an apprentice. Whatever. You know, I mean, we should do a podcast just on assisting, because I think Chase could probably interject quite a bit there. There's a ton to learn. Go work for somebody. Learn all of the stuff that you're asking me on social media and DMing me. You'll learn all that working for somebody, you know, all of the questions about the business and just all of this stuff. You're going to interact with your clients better. You're going to take better photos. You're going to know more about the business, all of this. Go work for somebody for a little while and then hang your shingle. I think it's crazy that everybody runs down to Costco, buys the latest Rebel kit, starts throwing up their Craigslist ads and doing $25 sessions in the park, and before you know it, they've moved on to, they've watched a few tutorials or something, and all of a sudden they're doing architecture photography or real estate or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It's a shitty way to go. You're not going to get there. You're not going to get to the finish line the way that you want to get there. You know what I mean? You'll never win that race. So.
Yeah. Another thing too is the jack of all trade thing, man. Like, Well, I bet all I shoot is architecture and interiors. That's, I don't shoot anything else. And then you have these people out there that are shooting, you know, families and babies and weddings and products and sports and like, and they're not halfway good at any of it, you know? I think there's something to be said for specialization, and that's, it seems like, I don't know, there's maybe it's again, coming back to that world where I was a few years ago in the real estate world where, I don't know. I could go on a rant here, which I'm not going to do, but,
yeah, maybe next time, but
yeah,
you know, I've said it before and I aching it to like, having your car repair. If you have a BMW, would you rather take it to Joe's all car repairs, all makes and models, or would you rather take it to Hans's European, you know, German car repair or whatever, you know, who do you think is going to do a better job? Who do you think is more familiar with that car? Who do you think is knows that thing inside and out better? I think it's probably the guy that specializes in that. And I think clients look at us the same way and they go, hey, this guy, all he does is architecture and design photography. This is probably the guy that I want to hire, and not the guy who's shooting weddings and babies and cars and everything else. I mean, it shows in work usually. Now there's a few people out there that can do a lot of different stuff. You know, I shot product and food, and now I'm shooting architecture, but I see architecture as just a giant product. It's a rare thing to cross over from one genre to the next and be good at all of that, you know. And I don't, maybe I'm not good. Maybe I suck at all of it, but, which is why I'm doing podcasts now instead of out shooting something. But the, you know, I think I was pretty good at product. I got a tutorial on it, you know, and then architecture, I think I'm pretty good at that. And I approach them both the same way. It's just attention to detail, you know, looking at what you're doing and paying attention to the details and taking the time to try to do it right. You know, especially in today's day and age, like I said, where people are wanting more and more images quicker and faster and tomorrow, you know, you got to try to manage the client expectations and slow them down a little bit and go, yeah, I could get 30 frames today, but why don't we shoot 15 that are mega and just take our time and light them all right and really tell the story, and we'll give you images that are going to get a lot better shelf life. You're going to be able to use everyone. They're all going to be, you know, home runs instead of just a bunch of singles or doubles, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I've been on shoots with you before where it's, you have a list of like 30 or 40 shots that they want to get done, and you do it, but then you have the clients and the jobs that have like, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 shots, and you can take your time and you can light them right, and they look butter.
Yeah. And we've spent, I mean, you and I have spent all night shooting stuff before. Yeah, we'll go in
one shot.
Hours on a single shot, you know, just finding composition can take 45 minutes to an hour. And then lighting the thing. I mean, the way we used to do it with hot lights, putting bulbs into sockets and lighting paint and shit and all that stuff before flash. I mean, not before flash existed, but before we used it in our process, you know, it was just, it was a whole different thing, and it took forever, but the images look really, really good. And it's, the industry's changing. So you got to be dynamic in it, but you, at the same time, I think you still got to manage client expectations and try to dial them back a little bit and get them to understand that there is a creative process here. Mm-hmm. It's not just walking out, pressing a shutter, documenting a set, you know?
And the thing is, it's once you are able to slow them down, you're not being bullied by your client, you can sort of educate them and then deliver that set of photos and then explain to them, you know, why that photo took a half an hour to compose. And a lot of the stuff I shot last year, some of my clients are getting huge traction with stuff like, my one client was just on HGTV, the one I'm shooting for tomorrow. And she has this kitchen I shot for her that's getting like global traction. It's in print in Europe and stuff right now. I just told her, I said, it's going to be a full day shoot and you're going to get like 8 to 10 photos. And, at first she was like, oh, can't we do more? You know, but once you are able to just explain the process, explain why you're doing what you're doing, man, it's invaluable. And it's almost like once you get to a stage where you're doing such good work and these projects are getting traction, you almost have those clients held hostage, basically. Like they have to work with you because maybe Joe, the guy they were working with before who gave them 30 images, those projects were getting zero traction, but now you're getting them all this attention. So there's something to be said for that. Just slowing down the process, doing it the right way. And again, I don't want to work with a client that wants me to shoot 30 photos in a day. That's not my jam. I don't want to do that. So you know, educating those clients and being able to work with the ones that respect what you do, like that's the ultimate goal. And ever since I've sort of been pushing that or working towards that, like I love my clients. I'm not resentful. I'm not pissed off. I'm not working with people that don't respect me. And in return, I'm not respecting them. So that's my little tidbit for today.
It's a better way to work for sure. You're less stressed out. Clients appreciate what you get a relationship with them, and then they start to trust you. What I find is they like to come out for the first shoot, and they realize it's like watching paint dry. They we're going to be there for the shoot, you know, and they come out, they send out their marketing person, whoever it is, they come out and they watch me move the camera 2 inches at a time for about 45 minutes. And they're like, okay.
And then the phone comes out and they're on the phone.
Yep, exactly. They're on the phone and then you get through three shots or so. And they're like, okay, this guy has it dialed. I'm just going to leave him alone. I'm going to go home and just, you know, I have to pick up my kid from school. Could you just text me when you're done with the shoot? And then, you know, and they take off, you know, and then they're never there again because they start to trust the process and they realize that we care, we're putting the time in. They see us moving pillows, they see us moving a lamp 2 inches to the left because it's got a tangent with something else, you know, and that's what makes you the more desirable photographer. That's what makes you so you can charge more. That's what makes it so that you can take what would other people would charge as a 1 day shoot into a 2 day shoot and make twice as much money. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, enough of that. Let's where can people find us, Barry? Let's see, Pixel Punishers.
Did you register a nice domain name for us?
I did, man. Pixelpunishers.com. That will take them to the blog site where we'll post these episodes along with the show notes, any links, any products, any promotion codes, etc. Where can they find you on the gram?
They can find me at Swizzler. That's SWIZZ or ZZ for the folks in America. SWIZZLER, Swizzler. And rosalindmckenzie.com, you can find our work there. You can find the tutorials over at proedu.com. We got some tutorials out.
What are those tutorials about?
Well, we have one about commercial architecture. Most of it is unwatchable, but the retouching part I heard is amazing.
Grandpa Frank's yummy meatballs, man.
And then I have one over there on real estate photography. And Tony also has one over there about product photography. So they've got a new subscription model as well, so you could watch all three of them and the rest of their catalog for a low monthly fee, or you could always go a la carte and download them. And where do they find you, Tony?
The gutter.
Yeah, whatever brothel or, you know, bar or whatever I happen to be scraped up from now. You can find me at Tony Roseland on any platform, doesn't matter, IG, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, at Tony Roseland. And mostly on IG. I've been using Twitter. You know, I've loved Twitter and I've tried to get into it, but I've just had a really hard time.
I've been on it since 2007 and I barely use it.
I know. I don't know why.
I like to read it. I don't like to post. I like to read it.
Yeah. I never know what to say on Twitter. Like a meeting.
What are people doing?
For a walk. What do you say on there? But you know what? And we'll lead into our next segment here, our final segment of the day. But I started following Elon Musk on Twitter, and that guy tweets like crazy, mm-hmm. man. So I've been following him on Twitter, and that's been entertaining. So I've been trying to do more on Twitter. I started our Pixel Punishers on Twitter. So if you're a Twitter person, you can grab us there. We're looking at those for the questions as well as Instagram. But anyway, I'm trying to use Twitter more. Chase, what if they want to follow you? Do you have social media? Are you online?
I'm off the grid. No, I am online. It's just I don't do anything professional-wise these days. It's just iPhone shots of my kid.
Okay, so for pedophiles, your handle is what then?
I am in the photos too. Usually. Okay. It's just my name, Chase_Warnick, WARNICK.
All right,
Chase
like
a dog, chasing dog, whatever.
There he is.
I do have a funny story about Twitter. So I'm not a Twitter. I don't tweet. But my mom likes to use the Twitter to troll Donald Trump, and she actually got blocked by him.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't know why she has a vested interest in Donald Trump, but she used to troll him, and he didn't like it anymore. So he's blocked. He's gone ahead and blocked her.
That's funny.
That's pretty good, man. That's awesome. I want
to
get back.
I don't know what kind of shit she was saying to him.
Yeah, you Canadians, I thought you were polite up there. You're getting blocked by the president.
I know, man. It's crazy.
All right, so let's finish up this podcast with Barry's bookshelf. Barry, what are you reading right now?
So right now I'm currently reading an Auschwitz book. I think it's called Auschwitz, the Untold Story or something, but
Auschwitz, like the concentration camp Auschwitz?
Yes. So I'm super fascinated by that whole period in history and the shit that went down there. So that's what I'm currently reading, and it basically goes all the way back to talking about how Himmler and Hitler got this whole grand idea. It was never intended to be like a death factory. That sort of just evolved naturally as the
things do.
when they annexed Poland, and they're like, what do we do with all of these Jews that are here in this new area that we've annexed? So it's fascinating. I mean, it's super sad, and the shit that went down was terrible, but I don't know why I have this strange fascination with it, but that's what's on the bookshelf right now. And I did order two more books that one is called 8 months in the Gas Chambers, and it's written from the perspective of one of the Sonder Commandos. So they're the guys that would have to clean up the after they gassed the victims. They would have to bring them up to the crematorium, and it's 8 months of this dude's life doing that. So I'm pretty interested in. I'm excited to read. I mean, I wouldn't say excitement's the right word, but I don't know. It's unbelievable that the shit actually happened.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's what my fascination is with the whole thing, but
I think the fascination is because it feels like fiction, but it's not, right? This shit actually happened, and it's unfathomable that it got that far. Right.
Yeah,
it's kind of mind blowing. And this wasn't that long ago is the crazy thing. So it feels like you're reading fiction, but it's not fiction. This is real life. This shit actually happened. And I think that's the mesmerizing part of these stories is like, holy crap, you know? So, you said two books you ordered. Is there another?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So there's one called, there was two that they're actually written by, they're from the perspective of the Sonder Commando. I don't remember the title of them, but, those are the two that I'm starting after the one I'm reading right now, which is sort of like the beginnings of what was happening. And then, just sort of goes through the entire process of how everything was developed all the way up till it was liberated in 1945. But, I just finished the book Night, and I would love to see that thing made into a movie. I know that the content would be super disturbing. I know that like Schindler's List is fairly disturbing, but I don't know. That's something I would love to actually to watch. I mean, they did crazy shit. Like the Nazis would throw babies in the air for target practice and stuff. Like it was fucking ridiculous.
Jesus, man.
Yeah. Right,
this podcast just went sideways.
Dark.
Yeah, really bad.
Real.
So those are all books about Nazis. We'll throw them on the website. So pixelpunishers.com, you can see the show notes. We'll put links to those books in the show notes. And if you're into baby target practice or whatever, Jesus. but anyway, that's Barry's bookshelf. To add to that, I just finished Elon Musk, which was a recommendation from Mr. Barry McKenzie. And man, you were right. When I bought it, you said 10 out of 10. It was absolutely a 10 out of 10. Great book. That's a Malcolm Gladwell, right?
No, it's Outliers.
Yeah, that right. I read Outliers right before that. What's the name of that?
I don't know. I heard it. The book's just called Elon Musk. I think it's a female author that wrote that.
That's right, dude. It was amazing. Whoever the author was. So I did book on tape or audiobook because I got a baby and I'm pushing strollers and doing stuff. And so I'm listening to audiobooks while I'm pushing strollers around, but absolutely amazing. If you're interested in that whole SpaceX, Tesla, Solar City, et cetera, the guy's a genius, man. He's super, super smart. It's a really cool story. Very well written and very well narrated if you're into Audible. So definitely check that out. I'll post that in the show notes as well. Thanks for the recommendation on that, Barry. With that said, anything else to add, gentlemen, before we wrap this podcast?
I don't have a lot.
All right. Well, I don't either, other than definitely go to Pro.edu, check out our tutorials, hit us up for a promo code if you want to come to the workshop in May. We got those last couple seats. And otherwise, we will catch you all next week. We're out. That's it for the Pixel Punishers podcast, episode 1. Thanks for tuning in, y'all. Leave us comments. Tell us what you think.